Today at Reader's Corner, Mary Elise Cerotti, author of The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall.
At the time, it seemed as if change would come to Eastern Europe. Gradually, through collaborative agreements between dissidents and local communist leaders, through semi-free elections, step by step. Both President Ronald Reagan and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev played a huge role in creating the circumstances that would allow the Berlin Wall to open. The triumphalist view that somehow the U.S. single-handedly opened the wall by itself is very dangerous. And so I think lack of knowledge of the crucial role of the locals has had a harmful effect on U.S. foreign policy.
I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In 1987, President Ronald Reagan challenged the Soviet Union's Mikhail Gorbachev to tear down this wall. 2 years later, the Berlin Wall was inexplicably opened, allowing East Germans free access to the West for the first time since 1961. How this happened is the subject of the book titled The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall by Mary Elise Cerotti. She draws on the accounts of real people on the ground to craft a compelling story of revolution, idealism, political infighting, deception, and incompetence. The Collapse was named a best book of 2014 by both The Economist and The Financial Times. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Dr. Cerotti. She is Dean's Professor of History at the University of Southern California and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Dr. Cerotti joins us by phone from Los Angeles for this interview. Mary Cerotti, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much.
I'm always fascinated by history books, and I spend a lot of time talking about them on this show. But I'm particularly rewarded when I run across one that not just helps me learn about a bit of history, but helps correct a previous interpretation of history. Is it safe to say that your book does just that, that it tackles a conventional wisdom that had us relying on that famous Reagan quote and on Gorbachev loosening things up in Russia to explain an event that was much more complicated?
Yes, I do try to take on conventional wisdom in my book, and it's up to readers to decide whether or not I succeed. Obviously, both President Ronald Reagan and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev played a huge role in creating the circumstances that would allow the Berlin Wall to open. I don't disagree with any of that. What my book tries to show is that what President Reagan and Soviet leader Gorbachev did was not enough, and that it took the courage of a lot of people on the ground to actually take advantage of that opportunity and to make the wall open. And so in a sense, I'm trying to put the East Germans into the story of bringing down this terrible barrier that had sealed them in. Mm-hmm. And so the book is about a lot of people you've never heard of, but who, it turns out, played very crucial roles on that night. So what I'm really trying to do is expand our understanding to show just how important the locals were, how significant their decisions and choices were on this crucial day in November 1989.
So, you know, our spring graduating class who came to Boise State right out of high school, they were born 4 or 5 years after this event. So they would have no way to recollect it the way I recollect it. And as it turns out, after reading your book, I realized that I didn't understand the nuances. I didn't understand the role of the East Germans. I didn't understand the role of incompetence in this wall unfolding. Do you think in American high school history classes there's any treatment whatsoever of this more nuanced approach to the collapse of the wall?
I only speak on the experience of the students I've seen at the university where I have taught. And the students, although they're generally very bright and very interested in the period, generally come to the college level with little history instruction about anything in the Cold War period. I see students in my classes who have learned about World War II and the end of World War II, but then have had no formal instruction beyond that. So my guess is that this story is unfamiliar to students today, and it's always a real treat as a professor to actually go through this amazing history through them of how, despite what Reagan and Gorbachev said, the East German regime was trying to cling to control and how they were outfoxed by some very cunning dissidents and revolutionaries. And so it's quite an amazing story. And once I share it with the students, they become very caught up in it and get very interested in it. But generally, they come to college without knowledge of it. And I suspect that's probably the case as well at many universities.
In your very successful effort to sum up, so to speak, just how this event unfolded and what were the causes, you say that the opening resulted from the dramatic interaction between long-term causes and shorter-term developments. Let's start right there. What were the long-term causes? In a way, I think you've already touched on those. That was, in fact, the role that Gorbachev and Reagan was playing. Then there were some shorter-term developments, which I guess is really what life was like in East Germany. And then we'll get to how that interaction was catalyzed by local actors. But again, take us through the long-term and the short-term here.
Yeah, obviously the long-term context is full of our context. For the purposes of this book, I look at the geopolitical struggle between the U.S. and its NATO allies and the Soviet Union. And when Mikhail Gorbachev becomes leader of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union, he realizes that the Soviet Union is bankrupting itself in this race and things need to change. And so he decides that he wants to find ways to create more openness in the Soviet Union, spend less money on the military, and ratchet down the tensions with the United States. And he surprisingly finds a willing partner in President Reagan, and they meet through a series of summits to ratchet down the tension. So that provides the context. But Gorbachev never intended to dismantle the Soviet Union or its power bloc in Eastern Europe, and he really did not intend to give up Germany. He just wanted to change the form of Soviet leadership. So that's the long-term context, which is you have some changes. This horrifies hardline regimes like the East Germans. And so they, as much as they can, despite Gorbachev's changes and the summits between Reagan and Gorbachev, they try to stick to Cold War confrontation. But the problem is that the citizens of East Germans, their expectations have been raised by Gorbachev. Suddenly the oppression that they've quietly accepted for years seems like it might be transitory. Suddenly seems like they might be able to get rid of that oppression. Mm-hmm. And so the East German regime, in a very clumsy and complicated fashion, tries to hold on to control, and it squeezes so tightly that actually people start to slip beyond its grips. And the regime makes a series of mistakes that I detail in the book, and it allows dissidents to gain ground. And then, of course, the most dramatic event is the mistakes on the night of November 9th, which lead to the accidental opening of the wall.
Wasn't economic mismanagement one of the shorter-term developments, the fact that things weren't going too well in East Germany?
Shorter-term and longer-term, yes, exactly. The country was indebted heavily to the West, and once things started to go horribly wrong in 1989, the East German leaders took a long, hard look at their own situation and realized that they were going bankrupt. And there was actually a very intriguing internal discussion of the possibility of, quote, selling the Berlin Wall. In other words, they realized that the Berlin Wall, in some ways, was one of the most valuable assets. And the East German regime just started to think about, well, maybe we could open a few more holes in the wall and in exchange get more financing, more support, more loans from the West. So the East German regime was actually looking at ways that it could market transit across the wall when this horrible series of accidents happened and the wall opened without the permission or intent of the regime.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and I'm talking with Mary Cerotti about her book, The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall. You know, now that we're talking about the wall, maybe we should back up a bit. Why don't you give us a description of the wall itself, just what it was, the death strip, how many people tried to escape over that period from the time it was constructed in 61 until it was taken down in 89?
Sure. So the Berlin Wall stood, as you mentioned, from 1961 to 1989. Although we speak of it as the wall, in its physical form, it actually had many different manifestations. When the East German regime first sealed off West Berlin, it initially did so on August 13th, 1961, by means of barbed wire. So initially, troops rolled out barbed wire. And then workers started putting up basically bricks to construct an initial wall. But over the decades, that one wall became a wall complex or death strip where there would actually be multiple walls. There would be signal fences, which would trip an alarm if someone tried to climb over the fence. There were anti-tank devices. There were dog runs. On the inner German border, there were devices shot shrapnel, hundreds of pieces of shrapnel at anyone trying to cross. It was a self-triggering device. So it became a quite extensive border region, not just a wall. And over the course of the 1961 to 1989 period, you asked about the number of escape attempts. Perhaps one way to quantify those are to talk about the number of shooting incidents. And there were 1,700 cases where the border guards, border officials shot at people trying to escape. Now, there may have been other escapes where people tried to escape and those escapes were foiled without people shooting. But we know of at least 1,700 incidences where there was shooting involved at the border. There were, of course, many more attempts than that, but we can quantify those number of shootings.
You know, if you really want to get a good look at how East Germans were just pleading for their freedom and the lengths to which they would go to get it, you have to see the 2001 German-made movie called Der Tunnel. Which
yes, it's a very interesting movie.
Oh, man. I mean, it's really an exciting movie, one of the best I've seen. And again, it's based on actual events. It's obviously been added to a bit, I'm sure, but it's really a great depiction of just what folks would go through to try to get out of East Germany. Let's go back to the role that Gorbachev and Russia was playing at the time, because Gorbachev's loosening up of the Iron Curtain countries was not just about East Germany. In fact, it didn't start there. It really started in countries like Poland and Hungary. You could see a breakdown in cooperation. Explain to us how that plays into the East German situation.
The East German peaceful revolution took place in the wake of very dramatic events, as you just mentioned, in Poland. Of course, Solidarity had long been struggling to achieve greater political freedom in Poland. And what happened in East Germany would simply not have been possible without the success of Solidarity. Indeed, the East German dissidents whom I interviewed all repeatedly said that the example of Solidarity was hugely important. It inspired them, and they had close contacts with dissidents in Poland, as well as in Czechoslovakia and elsewhere. So Solidarity had been driven underground in 1981, but when Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in 1985 and indicated he was interested in reform, that enabled Solidarity to reemerge, and Solidarity activists succeeded in getting Moscow's agreement that there would be semi-free elections in Poland in June of 1989. And at the time, it seemed as if that would be the way change would come to Eastern Europe. Gradually, through collaborative agreements between dissidents and local communist leaders, through semi-free elections at first, in other words, step by step. And that, of course, was all happening in the wake of the Tiananmen Square massacre in China, which took place at the beginning of June 1989. That was in the back of everyone's mind. They didn't want to do anything too dramatic and provoke the kind of bloody reaction on the part of the state that had happened in China. So that seemed like it might be the way forward. And as I mentioned before, the East German regime was horrified by all of this. And actually, in the summer of 1989, even as Poland held semi-free elections, the East German regime held its usual fraudulent election, where the ruling party reportedly won over 99% of the vote. So the context was important because it made clear that change was possible, but no one was really certain on what would happen in Germany because in divided Germany because the East German regime was being so hardline.
So the issue here is the free movement of people across the national boundaries in the Iron Curtain countries, and Hungary plays a key role here. Explain what happens in regard to Hungary and how they decide to deal with this issue of the movement of citizens from one country to another.
So Solidarity is working long-term in Poland, and Solidarity achieves an agreement, as I said, of semi-free elections in the summer of 1989. In Hungary, the story is a little bit different because historically, Hungary had very close ties to Austria and once had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And so the Hungarian ruling regime decided to make travel to Austria for Hungarians easier. And the reason I specify all that is they didn't mean to make travel to Austria or the West easier for any other people, just for Hungarians. But the Hungarian leaders didn't count on the fact that when the new travel laws came into effect, hundreds of thousands of East Germans would try to take advantage of them as well. So East Germans show up on the border between Hungary and Austria. This isn't even their own country, because they hope that these new travel regulations will apply to them. And the Hungarian government doesn't know what to do, and it's trying to deal with this mass of East Germans. And finally, the West Germans contact them, and the West Germans indicate to the Hungarians, if you let them out, we will work cooperatively with you to solve this problem. And the Hungarian regime decides to throw its lot in with the West. The way I think of it is the Hungarian regime de facto decided to change sides in the Cold War. And suddenly in September, it says, you know what? Our borders are open for the East Germans too. Our borders are open. You can cross. Go ahead. And this massive wave of East Germans start pulling out. And that's the first body blow to the East German regime, because until then, they've been able to rely on their partners to keep their citizens locked in. As you said, it's about the free movement of people. And until the Eastern regime has been able to put a lid on that, Hungarians change sides. There's a hole in the Iron Curtain and people can flow out. The Eastern regime, very worried, and in response, finally seals its own borders entirely because they feel they can't really trust their partners anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's another mistake, because that creates a pressure cooker situation inside East Germany.
And speaking of that, the pressure cookers seem to be centered in Leipzig, Germany. What is it about the center of dissension in Leipzig, and how does this come about that eventually on October 9th, more than 10,000 people are expected to attend a weekly gathering? You can tell us how many actually did show up. But first of all, explain what really got this protest movement going.
Yeah, that was one of the surprises in my research, was just how important events were in Leipzig, which is a city in what was then the southern part of East Germany, a region historically known as Saxony. That city had long been a center of dissident activity. And so as these masses of East Germans are trying to flow southwards to get to Hungary, to get to Czechoslovakia, when the border is sealed, they get stuck in the southern part of East Germany. There are massive protests, not only in Leipzig, but also in Dresden, another Saxon city. And it turns out in Leipzig, the protesters are able to overwhelm the regime on its home turf for the first time. And this is hugely important. In fact, inside Germany, people tend to speak of the two ninths. In other words, November 9th, when the wall opened, but also October 9th, 1989, when the protesters overwhelmed the regime. That's that protest march that you just mentioned on the night of October 9th in Leipzig. The regime expects that there'll be 10,000 people or so, but it turns out there's actually 10 times that number, according to party estimates. And the regime is overwhelmed and has to pull back, even though it had deployed a number of assets and had been planning a Tiananmen Square-style event. The regime realized with that many people on the streets, it had to back down. And that's hugely important, because the regime has to back down on its own home turf. And that really gives momentum to the peaceful revolution now inside East Germany.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. I'm Bob Kustra, and our guest today is Mary Cerotti, author of The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall. Well, the regime backs down to the point where there's a coup. Why don't you help us understand the role that that plays in moving this whole process along?
Yes, absolutely. So as a result of this humiliating climb down in Leipzig on the night of October 9th, 1989, there is an essence of palace coup in Berlin as a result of what happened in Leipzig. And so a man named Egon Krenz, a member of the Politburo, who had long been the crown prince, stabs Erich Honecker in the back, organizes a coup against him, and gets rid of him. And this creates chaos and upheaval at the top at this crucial time. And that, of course, is then very important for the later events, because there's disorganization at the top, there's disagreement at the top, and Egon Krenz proves to be not up to the challenge of putting a lid on all of this.
Do I remember that years later, Krenz would try to take credit for the collapse of the wall? Is that right?
Not just years later, but shortly thereafter.
Oh, okay.
Shortly thereafter, he would say that he issued an order to open the wall, but no copies of this order have ever been found, and the people who should have received such an order, the people guarding the border, have said repeatedly in huge numbers, they never received such an order. They did not receive such an order. Instead, the documents and the evidence, which is plentiful, thanks to the East German secret police or Stasi, the evidence suggests a completely different story. Egon Krenz decides that what he's going to do is talk a good game in public, but change very little in private. So he decides that he's going to have a kind of public relations initiative to quiet all these crowds who are protesting. But in reality, he's not going to change very much. He's going to maintain the state's control over the movement of its people. That's going to be the heart of his strategy. But the problem is this idea of a new public relations offensive, this idea of talking a good game in public, when he starts to issue confusingly worded regulations that are meant to sound good, people think they're for real. People hear these confusingly worded regulations that sound like they might be an improvement and decide, hey, maybe I can take advantage of that. And that starts the cascade of events that I describe in the book that ends up with hundreds of thousands of East Germans pressuring to cross the wall because they've heard these announcements that aren't supposed to be real, but they're interpreting them as if they were.
So this gets us to the part that I think I enjoyed the most because it's all about the little guy. And again, he wasn't necessarily a little guy. He was an official, but he was way down the pecking order. I'm talking about Harold Jaeger. And one of your quotes, I think, really sums up Harold's role. You say, the agency of local actors was decisive in the final instance. help us understand what Harold Jaeger does, this guy who really doesn't feel like he's got the right orders in front of him, and he has to make some calls himself, and ultimately he makes the big one.
Yes, Harold Jaeger is an amazing figure. He is the man who opens the wall. Harold Jaeger was a deputy passport control officer at the Bornholmer Street border crossing between East Berlin and West Berlin. Now, that doesn't sound very promising. So why is he important? Well, it turns out he was actually the senior Stasi officer on duty at the border during the night shift. And de facto, the senior Stasi officer on duty at any border crossing was de facto the senior person. The Stasi officers wore border guard uniforms to blend in, but everybody who mattered knew who the senior Stasi guy was. Now, he was not a particularly high-ranking guy. As I said, he was the deputy passport control officer. It was the night shift. His senior officer was not there. And so he was not a very high-ranking person, but he was a figure of authority. And that was another aspect of the book, the research that really intrigued me. I realized I was writing a history of the middle. So in other words, in the final instance, it wasn't a history of the political elites, the people in charge who mattered. And it also wasn't just a story of the pressure of the crowds. There were these people, the sort of middle rank of authority, who when push came to shove were on the spot and had to make crucial decisions under enormous pressure. And in the final instance, as you quoted, they proved to be decisive. And so on the night of November 9th, Harold Jaeger is on duty at the Bornholmer Street border crossing between East and West Berlin. It's the biggest crossing between the two halves of Berlin. It serves both pedestrians and vehicles. And what's happened on that evening is that a spokesman for the East German ruling regime has announced what is meant to be vague new regulations about travel that are meant to sound promising but not actually introduce any change. This happens at a press conference. The problem is the spokesman muffles the announcement. He messes up so badly that people think he's really announced the opening of the wall. Now, Harold Jaeger is actually watching that press conference live, and when he sees it, he utters an expletive and then immediately calls his superior officer and says, what just happened on television? You know, the spokesman just says, well, it's open, but I have no orders. And his superior officer says to him, there's no opening of the wall. It's business as usual. And Harold Jaeger puts down the phone and says, that's bizarre. And then all of a sudden, people start showing up at the wall. And he calls the superior officer again and says, why are these people here? Do I have new orders? And his superior officer says, business as usual. And this repeats again and again. Harold Jaeger told me that he called the superior officers 30 times, and they always told him business as usual. And meanwhile, the crowds get bigger and bigger and bigger, hundreds of people, thousands of people. And finally, Harold Jaeger realizes something has gone horribly wrong, and he's been left in the lurch. And it's going to be up to him and his men to decide what to do. So that's why I focus on him, because in the crucial instance, he he's basically left alone with these momentous events. And that's one of the things that I found interesting about the book. So I'm glad that you found it interesting as well.
I did. And by the way, I might add, I don't think you found Harold Jaeger for your interview in the Hall of Heroes. You found him driving a cab in Berlin. Is that correct?
Yes, it's amazing because after all is said and done, this is a man who had worked for 25 years as a border official. And when he ultimately decides to give in to the pressure of the crowds and open up, among other things, he puts himself out of a job. And at the time, he was in his mid-40s, and he still needed to work. So after East Germany dissolves, he ends up holding a series of odd jobs, one of which is driving a cab in West Berlin. And he would occasionally have paying customers who would say, oh, can you take us to where the wall used to be? Do you know where that used to be? And I, you know, can just imagine what he would respond. That must have been quite an interesting cab ride when something like that would happen.
No kidding.
By the time I actually interviewed him, he had retired to a small cottage near the former East German-Polish border.
I see.
So I actually interviewed him after he had stopped working as a cab driver.
So I think you say in your book that official Washington over the years may have misinterpreted the collapse of the wall. And if so, what impact did that have or does that have on our relationship with Russia?
Well, to the first part of your question, the phrase from Berlin to Baghdad arose before the Second Gulf War. That statement, I think, contains with it the misunderstanding that the events in Berlin that opened the wall were a combination of actions by the United States, but also by the Germans on the ground. So what matters is the interaction of Washington with the locals. But the triumphalist view that somehow the U.S. single-handedly opened the wall by itself, single-handedly democratized a country by itself, and can simply repeat that elsewhere is very dangerous. And so I think lack of knowledge of the crucial role of the locals has had a harmful effect on U.S. foreign policy in places quite remote from East Germany or from Europe altogether. Mm-hmm. So as I say in the book, I try to challenge this notion that the U.S. can simply go from Berlin to Baghdad and elsewhere without understanding the critical role of the locals. And as you know, and as we've been discussing, my book is very much about the locals in divided Germany. But even if you're not interested in divided Germany, I think the story has broader applicability about how the U.S. needs to work with the locals in a variety of other locations. To the second part of your question, relations with Russia, this time period has a huge impact on relations with Russia to this day. As I mentioned before, Russia this week will be celebrating Victory Day to mark the Soviet victory over the Nazis. The weight of history will be hanging heavily in the air. And Vladimir Putin, the Russian leader, has a personal memory of this history. In the time period I'm describing, he was actually in East Germany. He was a junior KGB officer in the city of Dresden. And he personally was horrified by what he saw, had to defend the KGB office in Dresden against protesters, and returned home full of bitterness at what he had witnessed. He said this in a number of interviews. He thought it was shameful how the Soviet Union lost its position in Eastern Europe, a position he thought it deserved to hold. And Putin has said in a number of contexts that and this is quite a remarkable statement, he said that the worst catastrophe of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, if you think about that for a minute, there's a decent amount of competition for the title worst catastrophe of the 20th century. And he's saying it's the collapse of the Soviet Union, it's these events that I'm describing to you. And his bitterness at this time period and at these events, I think, is behind a lot of his actions today and does make Washington's relationship with Moscow to this day very fraught.
Mary, we've run out of time, but I can't thank you enough for coming on and doing this interview. This is an outstanding book. Again, the name of the book, The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall by Mary Elise Cerotti. Mary, thank you so much for joining us today on Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Mary Cerotti. Next week, Stephanie Witt, editor of Cities, Sagebrush and Solitude, Urbanization and Cultural Conflict in the Great Basin. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.